Okay, folks. So, as some of you know, I kind of pay attention to my intuition in terms of what I'm talking about at any particular point, and sometimes it's st stretches me a little bit. So this is sort of a stretch. And for you, those of you who haven't been here before, this might be a little bit of a stretch, but happy to talk about it afterwards. Let's see where we go. So the theme is that the absence of a substantial self makes liberation possible. So the fact that they're anatta, no self, is the case from a Buddhist point of view, makes liberation possible. In fact, as we'll explore, it's a necessity. So let's see where this goes. Because one of the biggest leaps for many Buddhist practitioners is getting their hearts and heads around the idea of not self, which is similar in a Mahayana tradition, emptiness. But both of those are a big stretch, because it seems so counterintuitive, and especially not self, because we have this personal life, and you know, that's what we spend most of our time doing, is defending ourselves and trying to get the good stuff and trying to push away pain and challenges. And that's what we do for lifetimes, maybe lifetimes, not just this lifetime. So to see it a whole different way is a big stretch. And that's why, you know, it's no surprise that this idea, this sense of a lack of inherent self or anatta, is so puzzling, even uncomprehendable, which seems not to be a word, but it sounds like a word to me. I looked it up. Uncomprehendable for many people. We can't, it's anatta is the Pali word, and we just can't get it easily. It's counterintuitive. It's almost like precisely the counterintuitiveness of it is, in fact, where our journey lies. It is the way forward to see it, to undo what is sort of instinctively the case in our, you know, a sort of our animal conditioning, you might say, or the selfing conditioning. But we get hints of this. It's incremental in our practice, in our mindfulness practice. We get hints of it. And that's what's so cool about this. It's not like big switch at some point, and we kind of aspire to something way off there, and God knows if we'll ever get it. It's incremental, and people change over time. Piece by piece, bit by bit, our moments of mindfulness, they start dismantling this rigid sense of I, and we end up in a very different relationship with that over time. Because in practice, we might remember some longing in our hearts that's just kind of very dear to us, something we identify with. And with a awareness over time, we'll come up against again and again and again, maybe over years in practice. And it starts to, the edge comes off it. It starts to dismantle a little bit. We thought it was me. And it's like, oh, it's not me. It's just that. It's just that memory. And the same with a desire, maybe something we want, we wish we had, and it kind of burns at us. And if we're being mindful, it becomes not an obsession, but it starts to unobsession. We start to see through it. We hold it more lightly. And all these are incremental bits of seeing anatta, seeing not self, because most people, that which a person thinks they are is made up of all that stuff. That's what we are. That's what our conventional self is, a whole, you know, a whole tapestry of all of our conditionings, our wants, our woundings, our everything, our memories, our patterning. All that stuff is that conventional self that we hold so dear. And the same with fears. It slowly, slowly attenuates over time. So that's a beautiful thing about practice, that is taking us away from stickiness. So tonight we're going to touch on kind of an ultimate sense of not self, which is how the absence of a substantial self makes liberation possible. Or another way, nibbana is only possible because there is no inherent self. And you can see how this lands for you. But it's an interesting exploration, and I think actually really helpful. And I didn't make this up. There's one place the Buddha talks about this, and it's in SN, so Samyutta Nikaya, the Connected Discourses, 22.1, he says, bhikkhus, form is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering is not self. What is not self should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees this, one becomes disenchanted. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. We're going to kind of unpack that. But that's, the Buddha said that. And Tsongkhapa, and this is, as some of you know, I have a bridge into Tibetan practice. So it's going to be, this my friend over here is very, in fact, we have a similar, same teacher, Alan Wallace, in part of our heart history. And Tsongkhapa, he was a great 14th century founder of the Gelupa school, the newest of the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. He said this really crisply. He said, if the self existed inherently, liberation would be impossible. For if it existed by way of its own essence, it could not be transformed. The afflictions would cling to it as real, and no antidote could counteract them. It is only because persons and phenomena are empty of intrinsic nature that bondage and liberation are possible. So if Tsongkhapa says it, he's incredible. Tsongkhapa is just amazing. So let's take a little look at this and see if there's some ways we can unpack it for all of us. And let me just say, my goal here, as it always is to share stuff that's actually helpful. This is not an academic exercise. You know, if any of you or some of you or all of you walk out of here with one or two things that go, oh, that's it, that changed something, then that's good. So I'm trying to do this in a way that actually connects with the heart and makes a difference. And this is stuff that's hard to define. Nibbana is a word for awakening in Pali, nirvana in Sanskrit. And that is the goal of the Buddhist path. And so inherently, you know, almost impossible to describe what it is because we're not awakened yet. But it is the goal. And the Buddha talks about it all the time in the suttas. He's pointing us at that. And all the great Tibetan masters, they're pointing us at that too. So it's such a fascinating thing. We're going towards that which we do not yet know what it is. They often use the phrase a finger pointing at the moon, kind of pointing in that direction as best as we can, keep moving in that direction, and it clarifies over time. And to be sure, I do not claim to be awakened at all. But you have to go to the great ones to hear how it is. But I'm here, you know, I'm here in the stew with you all, but I'm definitely moving in that, doing everything I can to move in that direction, especially since I just turned 77 and, you know, death is nigh in some level. So pedal to the metal, as they say. I think they say that. I think that's a Dharma phrase. So there are many ways. So my idea is to kind of reverse engineer a little bit. Let's talk about what Nibbana is, some of the ways that it's talked about, and then go backwards to see why it is that not self is essential to get that. Because there's many ways to articulate what it is, but four key understandings are the unconditioned, dispassion, not clinging, and ultimate peace. All of those are qualities that are often articulated in the suttas about a being who's in a state of awakening. They have these qualities. Yep. The unconditioned, dispassion, not clinging, and ultimate peace. Those are pretty much from a Theravada point of view, but again, we'll be pulling in a little bit of Mahayana too. So to bring the unconditioned and all of these into perspective, let's briefly consider the Four Noble Truths, what the Buddha first taught, and the very bedrock in every tradition of what the Dharma is that, how do I say, for unawakened sentient beings, the reality is unsatisfactoriness. They depend on stuff that's unsatisfactory. They call it dukkha. Also called suffering, but that just seems to have sort of a heavy connotation. But the result of unawakenedness is an unsatisfactory existence because we're tied to stuff we can't actually tie to. The second is the cause of that. The third is the possibility of freedom from that. And the fourth is the Noble Eightfold Path. So that's the Four Noble Truths. And the Buddha, you know, he never said that all of life is unsatisfactory. He said that unawakened life is unsatisfactory. He himself actually several times said he's happy. He's happy in life, no matter what happened. And actually some very gnarly stuff happened in the Buddha's life. I mean, just as an aside, I've said this before, but it's, you know, we think, I know I'm very careful not to get political, so I never mention a candidate or a political party or anything from the seat. But nonetheless, difficult times, get that. In the Buddha's life, his two chief mentors, King Bimbisara and King Pasenadi, were both overthrown by their sons, or they were his friends, basically, his neighboring kingdoms. He went back and forth during his 40 years. They were both overthrown by his sons. Both of them died during the Buddha's life, which is pretty amazing. His own Sakya family was attacked and overrun, and most of his relatives killed during his life. His cousin Devadatta was constantly trying to kill him during his life. And he himself had back pains, splinter in his feet, a stone splinter in his feet, but he had chronic back pains. And you know, it was as gnarly, if gnarlier, than 2025. But he was happy in the middle of it. So that's beautiful for us because I got a sense that we've had gnarly conditions in some of our lives, right? So how do we be happy in the middle of that? So he clarified why we suffer. What brings dukkha, which is attachment and clinging to conditioned things? If things are arising and passing all the time, everything's changing constantly, right? That's called anicca. It's impermanent. So how unsatisfactory is it to try to adhere to something that's going to change? It's like going into a room full of ball bearings and trying to stand up, be still. It's going to slide out from under your feet. No matter what it is you thought was going to make you happy, it won't stick around. That's just how it is. And our Dharma journey, this conditioned nature of everything, everything arises from a prior condition, there's cause and effect, there's a whole flux of change going on all around us, it gets more apparent. Our Dharma practice, you know, the very, sometimes when we sit and we witness, well, I was thinking about you know, we sit and wish we could just be still and poised, but our mind goes nuts. That's often what happens when we first sit, is it seems we seem crazier than we thought we were beforehand. Actually, what we're just noticing is how busy our minds are, right? But it's the epitome of seeing change. People who practice see change much more so than people who don't practice. It's constant. We see constant change. And we learn that's how it is. We become less sticky with it. It's like, okay, that's how it is. So less of a tendency to want to stop it. And that is reducing suffering. And this impermanence has multiple implications, including not self, but we'll come back later. But the key point is that everything is conditioned, dependent on a prior cause, and thus ultimately undependable. And that, you know, that would undermine our urge to acquire things, to try to get stuff, to make things be okay if we knew it wouldn't work. And that's dispassion. As we become aware of this conditionality, it becomes clear there's just no point in chasing stuff around to bring inner peace. This comes from the inside, not from the outside. And so it's pretty almost funny when you be around people who practice for a long time and a whole bunch of stuff they used to do, meh, they just don't want to anymore. Like, spend a whole bunch of ruckus to go sailing for a few hours? Why bother? You know, you could just sit under a tree and be present. Why, you know, why seek experience if it's just changing, changing, changing? And people, it changes people so that they're much more at ease just with what is, because they know that it's changing. And this is genuine renunciation, is falling away. It's not like we're pushing away stuff we really wish we had because it's sinful. It's just falling away because we see it's just not going to take us anywhere. So that's dispassion, kind of unpacking how these elements of awakening are in us and how they fit together. And not clinging, that was the third of that little list. It's a deeper step because once you've crossed the bridge of dispassion, it becomes clear there's nothing internal or external to cling to. Nothing to identify with. It falls away in a very fundamental, irreversible kind of way. And this includes our sense of self. But it's profound and transformational. Because people, you know, in the world, they become identified with what they cling to. They cling to their jobs, they cling to their roles, they cling to their power, they cling to their possessions, they cling to all kinds of stuff. And it's shocking when that changes for them. But the more we learn to not cling, the more we're free, no matter what. And this brings us to this piece of Nibbana, so profound, that the Buddha declined to say exactly what it is, but there's some key words that we've been talking about that point in that direction. There's a Pali word, santi, which means peace and stillness. And often the English words can be puzzling to work through, because Nibbana is often translated as cooling, and then sometimes even as extinguishment, which sometimes people think that means the Dharma path is like extinguishing, going black, and that's sort of the goal. It almost sounds kind of negative, and why would you do that? But this is where I think the Mahayana path brings something that's really helpful for us. I mean, I'm kind of both, but for Theravada practitioners, it kind of broadens out what the goal is. Because awakening in Mahayana and Tibetan tradition itself, it's, for one thing, it's based on bodhicitta, which is the intention to awaken for the sake of all sentient beings. So it broadens out what awakening is. It's this very heartfelt sense of turning toward the welfare of all sentient beings. You can see that in reading this book by the Dalai Lama, that great, beautiful joyousness he has. And that's common among many great Tibetan masters. You can see how it's, they're just pulled out of their own self-dwelling into this awakening for everybody, for all sentient beings. It's really beautiful. There's this very kind of compassionate aspect, excuse me, that seems far beyond just extinguishing. There's something really expansive and loving. And then Dzogchen tradition, and Dzogchen is within one of the four schools, the Nyingma school. It's the highest, called Atti Yoga, the highest level of that. But it points to what that tradition considers a clear light nature of mind, or Rigpa. And it's a sense of a pristine awareness is empty yet luminous. It's empty of inherent existence, yet it's luminous. Right there, that stretches your heart. So I mention that because, you know, it's funny, here in 2025, compared to 30, 40 years ago, when I was 30 years ago, when I was first moved into Buddhist practice, I talked to some kind of elders. There's a way in which things were much more siloed, because there was, you'd meet this teacher or that teacher, and people would very much be in this tradition or that tradition. But now, like younger, I meet these younger people these days, and they're like all over the internet, and they're learning stuff in an authentic way from different places, and is working with how their karma. And so there's a lot more interlacing, even though, and on the one hand, it's very important to focus on one thing and get really good at it. And on the other hand, it's just how it is now. So I kind of try to embrace that. It's how it is now. Empty yet luminous. And, you know, how all this fits together, ultimately, I don't know yet, because I'm not awakened, but I'm on the path and sharing as best I can. So forgive me any mistakes. And sometimes, excuse me, I apologize for anyone, I'm shouting, I should mute it. Sometimes the way things don't seem the same in different traditions are kind of uniquely puzzling, and I don't know what to think. Like rainbow body. In Tibetan Buddhism, is a whole phenomena where highly awakened beings, they leave in a rainbow body and manifest into all these colors of light at the end of their lives. That doesn't happen in Tibetan tradition. Theravada tradition, as far as I know. Does it a matter of levels? I don't know. I don't think so, personally, but it's different. Sometimes you hear people talk about Ajahn Chah, Pai Master, like he was also almost sort of shimmering in light, and he kind of was there and not there because he was so amazing. So the point being, you know, bigger than we can nail down logically, but we can point in that direction and get a sense of where we're going and be open and keep changing with it. And even in the suttas, there's little flavors where that suggest some opening to what I'm just referring to, the quote I often use, and it's in the numerical discourses. The Buddha said, the mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. So that's language. It sounds a lot like Mahayana. Luminous. There's a lot of people debating what he meant about that little sentence. A whole bunch of stuff has been written about it because it sounds kind of Mahayana. Okay, so that's language. It's a sense of what the Buddha taught when he told us to focus on nibbana. So what does all this have to do with the reality of not self as a requirement of awakening? And this whole idea that were it not for not self, we couldn't awaken at all. So let me read the Tsongkhapa quote again, because it's so great. If the self existed inherently, liberation would be impossible. For if it existed by way of its own essence, it could not be transformed. The afflictions would cling to it as real, and no antidote could counteract them. It is only because persons and phenomena are empty of intrinsic nature that bondage or freedom from bondage, I think there's a word that's missing there, and liberation are possible. So let's look at those four things we were just talking about. Conditionality, that everything is a result of causes and conditions. That tells us there's no inherent self. Because as we look into our practice, as we're mindful, we never find a self. For most people, you know, that's a common experience. You don't find a self. You see a constant flex of conditions, interconnected parts, different aspects of that which makes us up. But you can't find this little homunculus, is that the word? This little thing that captures intrinsic self there. As many of you know, the Buddha talked about the five skandhas, form, vedanas, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. These are a list of five, as Buddha's put in full of lists, the list of five aspects that we make a sense of self from. And these are all phenomena that emerge in our mindfulness practice. It's a really handy list to work with. You know, you're sitting practicing and you're very aware of your body. You're aware of the vedanas, which is when things are pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. You're aware of your perceptions, all these different parts. And you can start to see mental formations, you know, as planning and thinking and all that stuff. And then consciousness, you know, we're conscious of, and we think, oh, that's me, I'm conscious of. Well, actually, it's just consciousness. You don't have to posit a me for that to be the case. So the more we're aware of that, the more you can use the skandhas as a way to look, to work with your awareness and see if you can, you know, it's up to you guys, see if you can find a self or not. Do your own exploration for sure. I'm just offering something. But this question about not self is actually, there's some interesting history here. In the Buddha, as some of you know, he awakened in Bodh Gaya, and then he tried to think of who he could teach to. And he thought of teaching to his first, the teachers, the Indian teachers, the yogis, basically, who had taught him stages of concentration. And then he realized that Deva told him that both of them had just died. So that wasn't going to work. And then he thought, oh, maybe I should teach the five ascetics with whom he'd practiced for many years. The Buddha had been a very extreme ascetic. He'd almost died from starvation during the period before he awakened. And so in his mind's eye, he saw that they were in Sarnath, which is just outside of Varanasi, and which is about 150 miles from Bodh Gaya. So he just started walking there. And he gave two talks there. One was the talk, the first turning of the wheel, first talk where he talked about the Four Noble Truths. It's very beautiful. The second talk, which is what I'm touching on now, is when he talked about not self. And that's really radical when you think about it, because here he's in a Hindu country and Sarnath is outside. It's 15 kilometers outside of Varanasi, which is the holiest, the holy ancient city of Hinduism. You know, it's been there thousands of years. Varanasi is amazing. It used to be called Benares. So Sarnath is right in the sphere of the very core of very orthodox Hinduism. That's where he goes, because he knows his ascetics are there, why ever they were there, because they were out of that tradition. Buddhism hadn't even happened yet. And he brought to them this idea of not-self, which was like unbelievably radical. That's not what was in Hindu tradition. That's like one of the big, huge shifts in the Buddha Dharma. Because people thought, and this is, I was in Raja Yoga practice for many years, and that whole idea of Atman, there being, you know, a personal version of Brahman, and each of us had this Atman. It's kind of like a soul, and it's a Hindu way of looking at things. I'm saying it's wrong or right, you know, bad or good, whatever. It's just that's how it's looked at in that tradition. So to make this shift, just as a tiny aside, I have my own personal experience of this, because when was this? 1988. I was just starting. In fact, I was studying with Alan Wallace, 1988. Yeah, there's a year-long shamatha retreat at Cloud Mountain. Somebody to go to Cloud Mountain. That's why they built Diamond Hall, was for a year-long shamatha retreat. He and Genla Rinpo were leading that. But because of my weird Theravada nature, I got into my head to go to Thailand. And all my friends were saying, "What? Why are you going to Thailand? You should go to Tibet or Nepal or something." But no, I want to go to Thailand. So I went to Thailand and on pilgrimage and met, I've told some people this, so I apologize, but met Ajahn Chah and Buddhadasa, which is unbelievably extraordinary, incredible that I had that opportunity. And Ajahn Chah was in a wheelchair, and at least he couldn't express himself. He probably was conscious. Buddhadasa was totally there. And everybody was, they were off preparing. So I went to watch the Swan Moke, which is down south of Bangkok. And they said, "Oh, everybody's gone, but you can go talk to Buddhadasa. He's right over there." I went, "Oh, really? My God." So I did. And he was, you've probably, if you've ever seen photos of him, he's like sitting on a kind of a scruffy kitchen chair out in the middle of the dirt with chickens running around and a stack of dusty magazines. He was very unprepossessing. And I asked him, because of this very subject we're talking about, I said, "Is it true there's no Atman in Buddhism?" I was still trying to get my head around it because I was new to the Dharma. And he looks me in the eyes and says, "No, no Atman in Buddhism, no Atman." I went, "Oh, okay." Because it was, he had such presence that I kind of like accepted it in some way. Something shifted in my heart. Okay, so I say all that because in the second sermon, which is SN 22.59, the discourse on not self, SN is Samyutta Nikaya, or the connected discourses, by the way, for any of you who like to read the suttas, which I would recommend. So he says, anyway, it says, "Bhikkhus, form is not self. For if form were self, this form would not lead to affliction, and it would be possible to have it of form. Let my form be thus. Let my form not be thus. But because form is not self, form leads to affliction, and it is not possible to have it of form. Let my form be thus. Let my form not be thus." So get what he's saying? If it was us, we could tell it what to do with form. We could tell our bodies what to do. If that was us, we could say, "Body, be healthy," or whatever. And the same goes for, so too, with feeling, which is vedanas, perception, volitional formations and consciousness, the five skandhas. In all those cases, he's saying, it's not self, we can't tell it what to do. A really just a mind-boggling idea for people back then, for the five, he's just talking to his five disciples, kind of blowing their minds with this new idea he has. Seeing thus, he becomes disenchanted with form, with feeling, with perceptions, formations, and consciousness. Disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. So that's the, you know, the sequencing I was just taking you through earlier about the direction of awakening. And they say that from that very talk, I think all five awakened right there. That happened a lot. There were people who were ready, and of course, that was the Buddha. So people awakened right and left just because he said it. I don't know. Maybe that just happened. I don't know. Did anybody awaken? Anyway. So as we see that awareness of conditionality is an essential aspect of awakening, to be aware of the changing, we realize there wouldn't be conditionality and all these internal aspects if there was a static self. If there was a me, a concrete me, none of that would change. It'd just be me. In the 8th century, Shantideva, this amazing pundit who's written an incredible book called The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which I absolutely recommend. You've probably read it many times. Yeah. Shantideva studied it. He said, "If the self were truly real, it could not be overcome. The mind would cling to it forever, and freedom would never be found. Since the self is empty of essence, awakening is possible." So, I'm going to talk about. Think for a moment, what it would be like if Steve was just Steve with permanent characteristics. I'm going to talk about myself because I can point at myself and I won't offend anybody, but you can point at yourselves if you want. But that would mean if I was just me and intrinsically Steve, that would mean some core aspect of me would be exactly as I've always been. So how would that be? You know, when I was 13, I had certain qualities, fears, and visions, as I did when I was 20, as I did when I was 40. And certainly there's some interconnections, but I'm not who I was then at all in a whole bunch of ways at any of those times. I can't even recognize. I go back and try to look and kind of remember. It's like, oh my God, I can't even hardly recognize who that was. There's some interconnections, but there's not a concrete Steve there anyway. You just really look and you realize, oh my God, there is no such thing. There is no such thing. And, you know, over these years, hopefully for the better, but I've worked on growth. I've made mistakes. I've faced fears. I've accomplished things. We all do, right? And we become who we are now. But we weren't rigid any of those times. So you can't find, I would suggest, an essential Steveness, some core thing that hasn't changed. What would it be? Because in a practice of mindfulness, we slowly, slowly open, it gets subtler and subtler and subtler, and we see all these subtle aspects of ourselves like nested dolls until there's nothing left. And then you could say, oh, but what about awareness itself? Isn't that some essence we might think of as me? And that's the tricky one. And to be sure, a lot of religions think exactly that. They talk about a soul and, you know, so we need to look for ourselves. But consider your own exploration of it. And are you finding an essence of me? Are you finding I am aware? Or are you just seeing awareness? It's a subtle question, and you have to answer for yourselves. But from the Buddha Dharma point of view, there's awareness, but there's no I being aware. There's just awareness. It's not a me aware. It's pretty interesting how profound that is. There is no I that awares, and there's no I that awakens. There's just awareness. So I'm not finding the essence of Steveness in my practice, nor are any of you finding the essence of you, I would suggest. You're just becoming aware of subtler and subtler levels of awareness. There is aware. There's no I that aware. Here's what the great 14th century Tibetan master Longchenpa, I always referred to him as the omniscient Longchenpa because he was so incredible. And he said, the essence of awareness is empty. Its nature is luminous. Its expression is unceasing. Experience is neither mind nor anything but mind. It is a vivid display of emptiness like magical illusion in the very moment, inconceivable and unutterable. All experience arising in the mind at its inception know it as emptiness. So, not self, emptiness, same thing. Anatta refers to the personhood from Mahayana point of view. It's all phenomena, not emphasized so much in Theravada, but Buddha does talk about emptiness. So it's not really categorically different. And what, you know, Longchenpa is just pointing us to, the essence of awareness is empty. Its nature is luminous. So in terms of what we're talking about, of the process of awakening from dispassion to not clinging to awakening, then the key to this, one could say, these great teachers say, is there's ultimately nobody to do this clinging, and there's nothing to cling to. That's the other part. Nothing to cling to, ultimately. There's no phenomena that have inherent ultimate. There's no phenomena with intrinsic existence, and there's no person with intrinsic existence to adhere to those phenomena. Once we get that, that's freedom. Because what's the problem? There's no problems. The problem just went away. There's no self, there's no stuff. That's like completely free. But conventionally, of course, we do get attracted by things. And here in 2025, as we all know, just like we're bombarded with attractions, and we can experience what our attractions are. And I'm going to confess, and I was laughing because we're motorheads together a little bit. I'm a bit of a motorhead, I got to say. I've turned a lot of wrenches in my life. And I'll just confess that I'm a little captivated by the new Ferrari F80. Brand new Ferrari. Thing's amazing. It's incredible art. More than 1,000 horsepower. 0 to 60 in 1.9 seconds. And it costs $8 million. $4 million. $4 million. You know, just, it's so ridiculously crazy that you can kind of go, oh, attracted, and it means nothing. It's actually kind of a cool exercise, you know. And then they just, you can feel it and then just let it blow by. Right? It ain't going to happen. So it's kind of a cool exercise, actually. But But ultimately, there's this passion there. And over time with practice, these circles widen. And the things that, you know, I wanted, which is maybe fame, you know, some of you know about hello. I'm forgetting now. The four sets, the eight worldly dharmas, which what the Buddha offered, it's a roadmap of what attracts us and repels us: pleasure and pain, gain and loss, good reputation, bad reputation, and praise and blame. And I'm always amazed at those last two: good reputation, bad reputation, and praise and blame. That's what people want. You know, they put a ton of energy into doing that. And the more we practice, the more we free ourselves of that. We see through it. It doesn't grab us anymore. We're on the road to awakening. But all of that has to do with the sense of I falling away. That's why it works. So dispassion happens automatically. And we find things we're attached to, whether it's praise and blame or our own sense of self or our own sense of power or whatever, falling away. Because we see through the self that was attached. We see through the sense of thing that attached us. This is incremental moving in the direction of nibbana. And it becomes not clinging. And we're getting into the realm of cutting through the second noble truth of the cause of suffering as we do this. So it actually is really tangibly changing us and how we live in life. And if there was an inherent self, if we really had an inherent self, this wouldn't work. Because how could all this change happen if there was an inherent concrete self in any of us that was at some point defined? You couldn't ultimately have everything fall away if there was a concrete self. But because there's ultimately no self there, there's ultimately no limit to how much we can let go of grasping and clinging and identification. And we can see that not self is intrinsic to awakening. In fact, it's an essential part of how the entire path works, about what the Buddha taught to. And I'll finish, almost finished, two things. Patril Rinpoche was an awesome 19th century Nyingma master who just wandered. Patril Rinpoche is so cool because he was so unbelievably unpretentious that he just wore scruffy clothes. And people didn't even know he was a great master. He'd show up somewhere. There's some great stories about, because people knew about him, they just didn't realize that was him. And there was some great story about people knew that Patril Rinpoche was coming to teach, and they were all set up with a great throne, and everyone's waiting. And then he sort of arrives, and they're saying, go away, you scruffy little thing. Patril Rinpoche is coming, you know, go clean the kitchen. So he went and cleaned the kitchen. And everyone's waiting. Well, where's Patril Rinpoche? Finally, someone said, he's back there cleaning, you know. And he comes out and teaches in his scruffy robes and everybody awakens. So he's so amazing. And they say that he had so little stuff. He didn't have anything. He would like sit and practice in a depression in a hill. And then when he decided to leave, he would just get up and start walking because he didn't have anything. So he's incredible. The Words of My Perfect Teacher, an extraordinary book. I just recommend it totally. He put it very simply. His enigma. When you understand that the self is an illusion, you will see that clinging to it has been the cause of your endless suffering. If this self were real, liberation would be impossible. For how could illusion be undone? It is because the self is empty that the path of freedom is open to you. So this freedom, it isn't personal. There's no I that awakens. We kind of awaken from I. And the peace that arises beyond conditioning, beyond selfing, simultaneously radiant and aware. You know, and even though they don't articulate it in Theravada in that way, when Jason and I, we on purpose, we did a pilgrimage in the fall in Thailand, and on purpose got to be with some very great Thai masters, quite a few of whom probably are arhants, and they were, Ajahn Gana in particular, he was just radiant. He was just crazy radiant. He was so wonderful. Kind of like a Tibetan master. He just had this incredible, joyous love just pouring out of him. So I sort of don't get hung up on the traditions thing so much. This peace is beyond anything an I could manifest. And precisely because it's not posited on an I, all this is possible. The Buddha said about awakening and Udana 1.3, he said, when things become manifest through the ardent meditating Brahman, all his doubts then vanish, since he knows each thing along with its cause. When one sees the rise and fall of the aggregates, one is full of joy and happiness. To the discerning one, this is deathless. This is Nibbana. Let's sit for a minute.